This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. There is no shortage of national political news to talk about today, and we want you to join us at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. So let's get right to it with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. Ken, welcome back.
Thank you, Michael.
And we also have joining us from the University of Oklahoma, Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Dr. Bloom, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure as always. And also joining us today is Northern Kentucky University Associate Professor of Political Science, Dr. Ryan Salzman. Dr. Salzman, welcome back to our program.
Happy to be here.
All right, before we get started, let's turn it over to Ken.
Well, we have a trivia question.
Yeah.
And the trivia question is, obviously with the debate starting next week, hosted, the first one hosted by Mr. Wallace, Chris Wallace of Fox News. Anyway, the trivia question is, who were the candidates in the first presidential debate held in Ohio, and what was the year?
All right, so the first presidential debate held in Ohio, who were the candidates, and what was the year? You can call us at 513-419-7100 if you know the answer to that question. Ken, tell them what they'll win.
Well, can I interrupt for 1 second before we do that? Okay, they win a political junkie button. But can I just take, I know we have a lot to talk about this hour, but I want to say something now because I made a terrible mistake a few weeks ago and I needed to apologize. If I could just take a couple of minutes.
Absolutely.
I'll make it fast, I promise. But, you know, when we have the trivia question, you'll always ask me what the winner gets. And I'll usually say something silly like, you know, a week in Howard Wilkinson's house, you know, whatever comes into my head. A few weeks ago, I said something like the winner gets a week in Kenosha. Now, I knew the moment I blurted that out, it was a mistake. It, of course, we know about Kenosha, the scene of a horrific incident in August when a black man was shot 7 times in the back by a policeman, and then there was further violence, and there were more deaths. Nothing about that was funny. I never thought it was funny. Kenosha just popped out of my mouth, and I regretted it the moment I said it, and I regret it today. And the reason I want to take this just a little few seconds to talk about it only is because I know a lot of people were upset. I apologize to everyone who was appalled by my comment. It was a mistake, and I'm truly sorry. So I just wanted to get that off my chest.
That's Ken Rudin, the political junkie, and we do appreciate that. And our listeners appreciate you, maybe not in that particular moment, but if I know our listeners, they've heard you now, and we'll listen to what they have to say about it. Ken, we do appreciate you taking the time to
thank
do
you, Mike.
That.
Thanks for giving me the time. Thanks.
For sure. And again, the trivia question, the first presidential debate held in Ohio, what was the year and who were the candidates? The number is 513-419-7100. That's also the number to call if you just want to pipe up about national politics. And my goodness, it just seems like every month when we have this show, there's no shortage of critical issues to discuss, not the least of which this time around is the death of Associate Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is lying in repose right now in our nation's capital. This is a time to remember a significant figure in Supreme Court history, American history, but also a time to discuss what happens next politically, because obviously this creates a vacancy on the Supreme Court. President Trump and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Republican from Kentucky, have clearly indicated that they are going to move on this and they are going to move quickly. We've got a little bit of sound of Donald Trump, our president, and First Lady Melania Trump visiting the body of Ruth Bader Ginsburg lying in repose today. It was not well received by bystanders. That is a crowd of people chanting, "Vote him out," while President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump stood masked outside of the area where Ruth Bader Ginsburg is currently lying in repose. Ken, this situation is highly charged in an election year that was already incredibly polarizing. Yeah, please.
I would say it's not only because it's an election year, it's because who she was and who Donald Trump is planning to replace her with. Now, Donald Trump absolutely has the right, the complete right, to fill the vacancy. He is president until January 20th, if not beyond. He has the right. What eats me up is that all the excuses, all the reasons that Mitch McConnell and the Republicans gave 4 years ago in denying President Obama the right to appoint Merrick Garland to the seat of Antonin Scalia, who died back in 2016, that you don't do it during an election year, or you don't do it because it's going to change the ideological makeup of the court, and we don't. And they mentioned something called the Biden law, the Biden rule, which was just nonsense. So, all like again, my beef right here is not with the president; he has the absolute right, but blocking Obama's choice 9 months before the 2016 election, because it's an election year, and Mitch McConnell pushing through a nominee with 40 days to go before the election is the ultimate in hypocrisy. And it, again, I know I start every show by telling you what I don't like about the president, but this is, and the Republicans, but this is beyond, in my personal view.
And again, just a reminder, 2016 Supreme Court Associate Justice Antonin Scalia passed away 9 months before the 2016 election. And we didn't even know who the nominees were, technically, in the Democratic and Republican parties. But Senator Mitch McConnell blocked that by arguing we are going to allow the American people to decide who the next justice is. But now here we are, extremely closer, much closer to an actual election where the two candidates are clearly known and the race appears to be close, according to polling, and they're moving forward. And it's not just Senator McConnell, it's Senator Lindsey Graham, it's many others who are on the record as arguing that we shouldn't
Chuck
have
Grassley.
Moved forward back in 2016. We should absolutely move forward now. We're joined by the political junkie Ken Rudin. We're also joined by University of Oklahoma political science assistant professor Dr. Rachel Bloom and Northern Kentucky University Associate Professor of Political Science, Dr. Ryan Salzman. Dr. Bloom, the Democrats are also being criticized by Republicans and their media commentators about being on the opposite side of their position back in 2016. Is that a similar argument? Is that a fair argument?
I don't really think it is. In 2016, Merrick Garland was nominated well before the presidential election. In this case, we have someone who's been nominated or someone who might be nominated very, very close to the presidential election. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died in January or March or even June, I think that the landscape would be a little bit different. But I think there's definitely room for Democrats right now to say that they aren't being hypocritical, that they really do want to wait to see who is the president, because that is what the voters' referendum. And at the point where the court is really the final arbiter, because the legislature right now is so weak, the judge becomes even more important to outcomes that will affect Americans for decades.
We'll note that Senator McConnell has explained his reasoning on why he feels differently now in 2020 than he did in 2016, because this time he believes the American people have decided who's selecting the next Supreme Court justice. He notes that President Trump was elected, and also that in 2018, the Senate majority for the Republicans was returned to office. And Dr. Salzman, it's an interesting contortion in which we find the senior senator from Kentucky. And because when you reference the Senate being returned by the American people, it's just basically not true, because only a third of the Senate seats are up for grabs. It's continually argued by Democrats that Democratic lawmakers in the Congress receive millions more votes. Donald Trump did not receive the most votes by Americans who cast ballots. How do you characterize McConnell's strategy here?
Well, it's clearly disingenuous that he would take this position, because let's just do a little, you know, mental aerobics here and think about if Hillary Clinton had won the election in 2016, do we really think that Senator McConnell would be sitting here saying, well, I guess we just got to go ahead and go on through with it because we know what's happened? You know, I mean, I guess that's just the case. No, absolutely not. That's absolutely not what Senator McConnell would do. But to go back to Dr. Bloom's point, you know, I think that we think about the hypocrisy of all of this in the context of 2016 versus 2020, but we have to frame all of it in the larger context that, you know, the Democrats were the ones to initially suspend the rules around getting judges appointed and sustaining the filibuster rule. And, you know, I have toddlers, I have young children, and it just smacks of this, like, well, he hit me first and they hit me second. And I don't know exactly who's to blame and exactly who's being the hypocrite here, but I'll just go on the record and say, I think they're all being hypocrites. And I think they all have something to blame. However, it has to stop eventually. It has to stop. And what's going to make it stop? That's what I'm wondering right now. What's going to make it stop? Because it could seriously get worse over the next few months before it gets better.
Ken, when we go back to that era when the rules for confirming judicial nominees at all levels of the federal court had changed, we're seeing a lot of blame cast on former Nevada Senator Harry Reid, who was the leader of the Democrats at the time and worked on that. It's not like it came out of left field. It was in response to what the Democrats in that period viewed as consistent obstruction by the Republicans on just about every judicial nominee that came from the Obama administration.
You're absolutely right. And Ryan is absolutely right as well, because when Harry Reid changed the rules in 2013, the reason he did that is because the Republicans, the Senate Republicans, which was the majority, refused to vote for any of Obama's judges. So Harry Reid said, this is ridiculous, it's obstructionism, we're going to relax the rules, we'll change the rules. So when the Republicans took over, they said, okay, because Harry Reid did this, we're going to get rid of the filibuster for Supreme Court judges as well, which means there was no way the Democrats could block whomever Donald Trump installed on the court. And therefore, this will be the third justice that that Trump puts on the court. But extending, you know, Ryan asked that question, when does it end? Well, the Democrats are now talking about if they come to power, when they come to power, whichever it is, will expand the Supreme Court. I think that's a mistake. Every time when something goes awry in the Senate, the grieved party just says, okay, we're going to change the rules. And as Mitch McConnell said in 2013, when Harry Reid got rid of some of the filibuster rules, Mitch McConnell said, you are going to rue this day. You're going to live to regret this change. And Mitch McConnell was right.
And we want to hear from you, if you're listening as well, how you feel about this situation, if you think it's the right decision for the Republicans to move forward with the Supreme Court nominee at this time. If you feel otherwise, give us a call at 513-419-7100. But I have to let you know, our phone lines are already full because of Ken Rudin's political junkie trivia question. So we better get some answers now and see if someone's correct so we can open up some lines to hear from our listeners. So let's go to the phone lines now and get some guesses from our dear listeners. First on the line is Richard. Hi, Richard. What's your guess on the trivia question? Do we have Richard on the line? Okay, Richard, the question was, the first presidential debate hosted in Ohio, who were the candidates and what was the year?
The answer is Richard Milhouse Nixon versus John Fitzgerald Kennedy in 1960.
Ken, is that the answer?
That is not the correct answer. You know, as a matter of fact, there were four debates with Kennedy and Nixon in 1960. One of them, actually, you had Nixon in California and Kennedy in New York. But of all those four, nobody appeared in Ohio during the debate.
Richard, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate you listening. Thanks for the guest. Let's go now to Adam. Hi, Adam. What's your response to the trivia question?
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
The answer is Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan in 1980, and it was in Cleveland.
Ken?
That is the correct answer.
All right, Adam. Awesome. Well done.
And can I just say something about that debate? You know, we always talk about whether debates matter. I think this debate mattered more than any other one in history because, one, Jimmy Carter only accepted one debate, which was a big mistake. Two, he did it a week before the election, and that was a mistake, too, because he couldn't respond to it. And three, going into that debate, Jimmy Carter still had a sizable lead over Ronald Reagan. Reagan was so masterful in that debate against Jimmy Carter. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? That right after the debate, Reagan took the lead and never relinquished it. That was one of the most consequential debates in history.
Awesome. Thanks for that analysis. Adam, congratulations. I'm going to place you on hold, and our producer, Selena Reeder, is going to get with you to get your address so that we can send you that political junkie button. Thanks for listening, and well done. We'll also note that that debate in Cleveland back in October of 1980, just days before that election, the famous line came from that. Let's hear it, Josh.
There you go again.
Oh.
When I opposed Medicare.
That's all right. That's enough of that. But there you go again. That's the line that came from it. I mean, it was just such an easy punch. It got a response from the audience. And so we're going to talk a little bit about the context of this. The reason that this theme was chosen for the trivia question this month is because next week is the first presidential debate between incumbent President Donald Trump and his Democratic challenger, Joe Biden. And we'll talk about what's at stake there and if we can anticipate any punches being landed there. But now we do have phone lines open for those of you listening who want to weigh in on the Supreme Court battle looming in Washington, D.C. Give us a call, 513-419-7100, or email your thoughts to talk at WVXU.org. Of course, we're joined by the political junkie, Ken Rudin, and from the University of Oklahoma, Assistant Professor Dr. Rachel Bloom, and from Northern Kentucky University, Associate Professor Dr. Ryan Salzman. Ken, what's at stake with a Supreme Court selection like this? Why the urgency? Why is this so important for politicians to place someone that they think shares their ideology on a court?
Well, there's always an important, whenever there's a new Supreme Court justice, there's always importance because they basically decide reproductive rights. They decide air quality. They decide voting rights. There are so many things that the justice will decide. And the fact is, when you're replacing, especially at a time like this, when you're replacing a very liberal judge like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was a champion for women's reproductive rights, to somebody who, look, Donald Trump promised that he will name judges who will support the repeal, the overturning of Roe versus Wade. So conservatives love this opportunity. Democrats fear this opportunity. You know that whatever you think about Donald Trump, he's probably the reason why Ruth Bader Ginsburg stayed alive as long as she did, because as she said to her granddaughter shortly before she died, that she wants to be replaced when there's a new president. She will not get that wish, but the fact is that a lot of things, especially in the thing when it comes to abortion, that will change from a 5-4. A nominally conservative court with John Roberts as the swing justice to a 6-3 court, which could mean that Roe is in big trouble.
Let's hear from President Trump about why he thinks there is a need for 9 justices instead of the way we operated for most of 2016 with just 8.
Oh, I don't think so. We need 9 justices. You need that. With the unsolicited millions of ballots that they're sending, it's a scam, it's a hoax, everybody knows that, and the Democrats know it better than anybody else. So you're going to need 9 justices up there. I think it's going to be very important, because what they're doing is a hoax with the ballots. They're sending out tens of millions of ballots unsolicited, not where they're being asked, but unsolicited, and that's a hoax, and you're going to need to have 9 justices. So doing it before the election would be a very good thing, because you're going to probably see it, because what they're doing is trying to sow confusion and everything else. And, you know, when they talk about Russia, China, and all these others, they will be able to do something here, because paper ballots are very simple. Whether they counterfeit them, forge them, do whatever you want.
President Trump has consistently diminished what many might view as the integrity of the election because so many people are voting by mail this time due to the COVID-19 pandemic. He's been talking a lot about the ballots and what he sees as irregularities in the way that Americans are voting and anticipating that this could end up in the Supreme Court. And earlier this week, just yesterday, in fact, he spoke again about the ballots. And now that has a lot of people, even from what I've seen, some conservative commentators concerned about the way that he characterized whether he would support our traditional transition of power as a peaceful transfer. Let's hear him. Do we have that sound, Josh? This is the president talking about the peaceful transition.
Win, lose, or draw in this election, will you commit here today for a peaceful transferal of power after the election? There has been rioting in Louisville. There's been rioting in many cities across this country, red and your so-called red and blue states. Will you commit to making sure that there is a peaceful transferal of power after the election?
Well, we're going to have to see what happens. You know that I've been complaining very strongly about the ballots, and the ballots are a disaster.
I understand that, but people are rioting. Do you commit to making sure that there's a peaceful transferal of power?
We want to have get rid of the ballots, and you'll have a very we'll have a very peaceful. There won't be a transfer, frankly. There'll be a continuation. The ballots are out of control. You know it. And you know who knows it better than anybody else? The Democrats know it better than anybody else. Go ahead.
Dr. Bloom, is there danger here in the President of the United States casting suspicion on the outcome of the election?
I think the danger here is obvious. He sounds like a dictator in a country that wants to pretend it's having free and fair elections, but really doesn't want to give up power. However, I think what he's doing right now is, I mean, on one hand, it's just characteristic Trump. He's creating his own reality as he speaks and then latching onto the sound bites he likes and then regurgitating them. But it runs the risk of muddying the waters of everything that's at stake. Because on one hand, we have this question about the legitimacy of democracy and of the courts and of elections. And then on the other hand, you have all these process questions. So how do we decide these things and who gets to arbitrate and do we trust those people? And when you start to question processes that occur in democracies, you get really close to questioning the legitimacy of a democracy. So it's fascinating because at the same time, he is saying, we need these justices on the court because the court is going to decide this and subtext decide for me, which implies that he thinks the court is legitimate in some way, but we can't have paper ballots, even though we have paper currency and all of these other paper things that we know very well how to check for counterfeits with, because that wouldn't be legitimate. He's trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Dr. Salzman, we're 20 years into this century, and the first time I was old enough to vote in a presidential election was in 2000, and I was a student there at your campus in KU, and also the first time I got to witness the guy who got the most votes not becoming president, and then that happened again 4 years ago, where a woman got the most votes and did not become the president, so twice in the past 20 years, we've seen this strange mechanism of the American presidential election in which the one who gets the most votes doesn't become the president. We've seen court cases over one of these. Is there already a diminished trust in the electoral system in this country?
There absolutely is. I mean, there's a diminished trust in all of our institutions, and some of that, I think, has been a somewhat natural occurrence of, you know, I don't want to put it all on the internet. Like, I don't think I'm that old to blame the internet for everything or, you know, something like that. However, you know, we've seen these declines in trust in all of our institutions for years now. And I think that it's been hastened in large part because of current leadership, not just President Trump, but then again, when we see what's happening in the Senate, we see that, well, maybe these rules aren't as sound. And even if they're norms, there's a lot of lack of sophistication and a lack of appreciation for the complexity of our system and how it works. And what I wish that I was hearing right now in terms of renewing our faith in the institutions, what I've been telling people who are bringing these concerns to me about the election is to say, there are 50 or 51 or 53 secretaries of state in every state that are responsible. It is their job to make sure that the election is done correctly. There are thousands and thousands of candidates who are depending on the election being done well, even in states like Kentucky, where the margin for the president may be, you know, very, very large. There are still going to be races that are very, very close. And candidates on both sides of the aisle and even nonpartisan races are going to have every motivation to make sure that this is done correctly. And I don't see a scenario where this is able to be completely toppled, like the rhetoric that's going around these days. We're so infatuated with the presidency. We're so infatuated with what happens in Washington, D.C., that we forget the fact that the United States Constitution requires that elections are administered at the state level. And here in Kentucky, we had a very successful primary, given the circumstances. And I have every expectation we're going to have a successful general election as well. And I think that all states, and again, candidates, are going to be ensuring the same thing to their people. And I wish that just for a moment, we would think about that reality and how difficult it would be to completely disrupt that apple cart.
We're going to
Michael, please. Michael, I'm sitting here and I'm jumping out of my seat, and I don't disagree anything with what Rachel or Ryan said, but listen to what the president said. He was asked whether he would accept a peaceful transfer of power. He says, we have to see what happens. We heard him say this, get rid of the ballots and everything will be fine. You know, there'll be a continuation. Get rid of the ballots. Look, I know Ohio is split down the middle between Trump and Biden. I understand that. I understand that the state went for Donald Trump by like nearly 8 points in 2016. I know there are conservatives and Republicans and Trump supporters who listen to this show. But listen to the president saying, if you get rid of the ballots, then we'll have a continuation. We'll see what happens if we can commit to a peaceful transfer of power. This is remarkable. This is unparalleled in American history. And I know there are philosophical arguments and constitutional arguments, but there's also outrage. And I'm glad the windows of my office are locked because I'm ready to jump. This is just crazy.
Please don't jump, Ken. We want to have you back on next month before the election. So take care of yourself.
Okay, I won't jump then.
We'll give you a moment to take a deep breath because we're going to take a break, and we will be back with your phone calls. That's what we'll start with on the other side of this at 513-419-7100. Ken, Rachel, Ryan, and I are back in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly, and I work for NPR, but that is not the whole picture. I also listen to NPR and advocate for NPR and stations like WVXU and WMUB. Local NPR stations are working overtime right now, trying to bring you the most up-to-date information to keep you informed and keep you safe. It is not an easy job, but it is one your local WVXU news team does so well. Do your part to support 50 years of reliable news. Give what you can at WVXU.org. And thank you.
WVXU is your faithful companion during normal times, but I'm guessing it's been even more important lately. This is where you turn for the latest updates and to hear the answers to the questions you want asked. We're all just trying to make it through this, and being part of this radio community helps. So right now, I'm asking you to give what you can to support the station at WVXU.org or by calling 513-419-7155. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with the political junkie, Ken Rudin. You're still in your office, right, Ken?
No jumping yet. Thank you, Michael.
All right. And also joining us, our University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science, Dr. Rachel Bloom. Rachel, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Northern Kentucky University Associate Professor of Political Science, Dr. Ryan Salzman. Ryan, thanks to you as well. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. We'll go to the phone lines now with Mary. Hi, Mary. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Actually, it's about that smooth transition of power. What if, and regardless of the ballot thing, and I know that's horrible, what the president, what he said, but if indeed he determines not to leave the White House, I mean, is there any legal way that he can be removed, or is that something, I know we've never dealt with that, do we know what would happen if he decides, I'm just going to stay here?
Thank you for the call, Mary. We'll hang up and let our panel address that. I will note that Senator McConnell tweeted that, quote, the winner of the November 3rd election will be inaugurated on January 20th. There will be an orderly transition, just as there has been every 4 years since 1792. And I'll note, Ryan, that those are remarks from a senator whose promises are in question now. He's the same person who didn't want to approve a judicial appointment during a presidential election year and is now rushing to do the exact same thing. So are Mary's concerns legitimate?
Well, you know, two thoughts there. One, I have no doubt that when, if the Trump administration ends, substantively on November 3rd, but then really ends in January, that Senator McConnell, you know, will do everything that he can to help with that transition and make sure that it happens. But, you know, I'll also add that, you know, this whole idea of like, I'm not going to leave the White House is very pouty. And I think about, you know, at the beginnings of like Christianity and religion, right? It's not the church. It's the congregation. It's not the building. It's not the White House. I mean, the White House is just a building. It's the individual. And if Joe Biden is sworn in on January, he can go to the local Hilton and he can set up shop and be the president of the United States of America. I mean, it's the White House. And then I'll just add that I think that this is, you know, really hyperbole by the president to follow this line of talk. He's clearly speaking to a specific segment, because the man clearly didn't have a plan for winning the election in 2016. And I don't think he has a plan for sticking around. I think the larger threat is that he continues to tear down our institutions by saying that he's not going to stick around for the transition of power. He's not going to stay and go with, you know, President-elect Biden, if that were to happen, and sit up there on the stage for the inauguration. I think that it would be like a final indignancy for the presidency that he would do that on the way out. But I don't think he has any plans. He's not organizing military or militias to do that. It's rhetoric is what I would say. And I would think that Senator McConnell, I'll take his tweet on this one at face value.
We got an email from Lloyd that says, quote, after listening to the hypocritical Republicans twisting themselves into knots to support rushing through a Supreme Court nominee, why would I believe the same Republicans speaking out today, including Senator Portman of Ohio, that they would absolutely uphold the election results were the Democrats to win? Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got Jake on the line. Hi, Jake. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, but he's conspiring with governors in state houses to change the electors. That's a concern of mine. I wonder if you've got some comments on that. Two other things. Can Kavanaugh be impeached for perjury? And can the Democrats stall by bringing forth articles of impeachment for Trump, several of which they have not pursued yet?
Thank you, Jake. We appreciate that. I don't know that there's been any exploration of impeaching Kavanaugh or substantiation to the conspiring with the electors, but we do have some sound from Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic Speaker of the House, about some strategies that could be deployed.
Well, we have our options. We have arrows in our quiver that I'm not about to discuss right now. But the fact is, we have a big challenge in our country. This president has threatened to not even accept the results of the election with statements that he and his henchmen have made. So right now, our main goal, and I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg would want that to be, would be to protect the integrity of the election as we protect the American people from the coronavirus.
And that was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, the leader of the Democrats.
Michael?
Ken, go ahead.
Michael, let me not dismiss what Jake just said right yet. There was a great article in The Atlantic talking about how Trump and the Republicans are talking to Republican state election officials around the country, because you know there's going to be challenges to many elections. He's going to say the elections are fake, the mail ballots are rigging the election. There's already efforts underway to work with Republicans to insist that there's some chicanery involved yet, and they could even offer their own slate of electors before the Electoral College meets in December. I really suggest everybody read this. It's in the current issue of The Atlantic. It is quite chilling.
Well, then my apologies to Jake. I didn't mean to just dismiss that, and thank you for referencing the article in The Atlantic. Ken, let's go back to the phones now. We've got John on the line. Hi, John. What's your question or comment?
Yes. Hey, guys, I've been listening to you guys for a long time. Everybody knows that. And everybody knows everything, the great things the president's done for even mosquitoes in this country. Hey, but I've got a question. Can you guys tell us what he's done for his own four casinos in Atlantic City? I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, John, thank you for the call. I'm not sure if I get the reference to the mosquitoes or the casinos. Anybody?
I get the casinos.
Okay, go ahead.
At least I think I know what the caller's talking about. Early in Trump's real estate career, when he was still working for his father, Fred, he was given permission to open a series of casinos in Atlantic City. And at first he was successful, but he opened four. They undercut one another. It was one of his first major public failings as a business person, and kicked off just a whole series of events where he continued to be able to get money from people, and they continued to prop him up because they didn't want to look like they'd made a bad investment.
Okay, so thank you for that explanation. I guess I was thinking that something more recently must have transpired.
It's possible.
Well, thank you for the call, John. We do appreciate you being a longtime listener nonetheless. I apologize if I didn't fully understand your question. You can feel free to call back. 513-419-7100 is the number. We'll go now to Anthony. Hi, Anthony. What's your question or comment?
Hello. Good afternoon. I just wanted to go ahead and make a little comment here about the consistent erosion of the so-called norms of society in general, not just within the areas of specifically the, I guess, let's say, continuation or the procedures in the Senate and House, which are, of course, up for grabs every few years since, I think, about the 80s when they started messing with the rules, but also with the various institutions which are apolitical but being used for political means. We have seen political appointees in the DHS, within the Department of Homeland Security, within the Department of Health, within the Department of Education. And it seems that also the politicization of the Supreme Court is another issue. It seems that, like, for me, when I look at this, the judicial branch or the area of law was meant to be set aside from partisan politics and political influence. But the further we've gotten since, I think it was the late 80s that they started really attacking these sort of institutions. But the farther we've gotten from that point when they started to flip the switch on partisan meddling within sort of apolitical systems, we've seen those gradually erode to the point where they are now, where we even have a president saying that he wouldn't necessarily agree with the election results.
Anthony, we do appreciate the call very much, and thank you for sharing your thoughts with us. Ken, I was wondering about this and sort of the same line of thinking that Anthony was offering to us, and thank you again for that call, Anthony. We're seeing polling data that suggests some states are in play this year for Democrats that otherwise wouldn't be, namely Texas. We don't know what the polls will end up being, of course. We learned hard lessons in 2016 about polling. But Texas appears to be somewhat competitive, relatively competitive, and that has a lot to do, apparently, with changing demographics there. And it seems like if Texas were ever to become a solidly blue state the way New York and California are, these big-ticket prizes in the Electoral College on Presidential Election Day, word of completely turn blue for the foreseeable future, then Republicans would have a very tall hill to climb in order to be competitive. Is there some maneuvering taking place here in order to find some safety net for Republican values, Republican policies, and other institutions after they've lost control? And let's also note that among the arguments being cast by some people who want to see a President Biden and a Democratic Senate majority make changes, not just to the number of Supreme Court justices, but adding Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico to statehood so that they would have two senators too, nearly guaranteeing consistent dominance by the Democrats in that chamber. Is this some protection by Republicans? Is this some insurance?
Oh, my. There are so many ifs in that whole conversation. Well, first of all, I mean, I think there are legitimate, and we said this in 2016 as well, because Hillary Clinton spent more money in Texas than people expected. There are changes going on demographically in Texas, in Georgia, in states that have been reliably Republican in years. I don't think they turn this year, but things are changing. As far as what, you know, but at the same time, you think of Wisconsin and Michigan, states that have not gone for a Republican since, I think, Bush in 88, and they both went for Trump. So there is a realignment going on in this country that, it's just fascinating where, I think the thing that I just object to the most is that I live in Maryland, and it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat in Maryland, because we know that the Maryland will go to the Democrats. If I were a Democrat in Mississippi or a Republican in Mississippi, it wouldn't matter because we know in advance where those states are going to go. I think it's kind of sad that there are only 10 states in the country that both candidates seem to care about. And if that's the case, you get a tremendous amount of either disaffection or alienation with many other voters because they'll never hear from the candidates again. That doesn't exactly answer your question, but I'm just aware of the fact that some voters, some votes are far more important than others.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue now with the political junkie Ken Rudin and University of Oklahoma Assistant Professor of Political Science Dr. Rachel Bloom and Northern Kentucky University Associate Professor of Political Science Dr. Ryan Salzman. And Ryan, I'll note we just got an email countering, I think, something that you said about the next president being able to set up in the Hilton if necessary. Paul writes to us to say, a President Biden would not have access to all the levers of our government and the CIC apparatus. I suppose CIC stands for Commander-in-Chief. The Commander-in-Chief apparatus located in the White House. Your statement is an insult to the smooth function and transfer of power central to our democracy. So I'll give you a chance to respond to that, Ryan.
Well, I think he's absolutely right. And I certainly didn't mean to insult the system by any means. I'm a big believer in our system. But the point being that simply hunkering down is not the same thing as maintaining power. I'm sure the author of the email would agree that having power and having those things to some extent can be disabled. And certainly if they could not, I'm not a national security expert, but I have no doubt that there are protocols in place. For instance, if we're assuming that the White House can only, you know, is some kind of central brain node from which all things can be done for the United States, then that just makes it the perfect target for some kind of invading army to come in. And once they get in, they're able to do everything that they need. So, I think that one thing that I would also say in response is that, I think using language like I'm being insulting is not helpful. And I certainly believe in the system. It's why I study it. And I do believe it. It's also why I'm an elected official in my community. So, I hope that we can all appreciate that we're trying to navigate through hypotheticals through all of this. And the reality is that if President Trump decides that he doesn't want to, quote, leave the White House, then that does not make him remain president. And I will stick by that.
Okay, we are short on time, but I want to get to some callers. So if you are on hold and we get to you, just make sure you ask your question or make your statement quickly so we can try to fit some of you in. I've got two mics on the line, so I want to note that the mic I'm going to call on now is the one who wants to ask about whether the president is decided by the Supreme Court. So if you're that mic, hello, and go ahead with your question or comment.
Yes, that's me.
Okay.
My question, first of all, statement, Trump's latest nominee is approved by the Senate, that will mean that five of the Supreme Court justices will have been appointed by presidents that did not win the popular vote. And I find that pretty much abhorrent to start with. I have no doubt in my mind that one of Trump's considerations when interviewing justices is his oath of allegiance, which he requires of a lot of people, which is, I'm sure, completely illegal. But is there any method to recuse justices who have been appointed by Trump if a decision comes down to the Supreme Court?
Mike, thank you for the question. Does anyone have an answer to that?
Absolutely not. I mean, the Supreme Court has the right, will have the right, as we saw with the court in 2000 with Bush v. Gore, whether you're appointed by a Republican, by a Democrat, whether you're appointed by Bush or not, even if those appointed by Bush, well, actually, nobody could have been appointed by Bush because he was no president then. But yes, they do not recuse themselves. They vote.
And let's go now to Roger. Hi, Roger. What's your question or comment?
Hi. It's possible that Trump might again lose the popular vote to win the Electoral College. Has Biden been asked whether he will support the continuation of the administration if the people like rioters in Portland and Seattle take umbrage with the result?
Thank you for the call, Roger. We appreciate that. I'm not sure that I've seen former Vice President Biden asked whether he would accept the results, at least not as prominently as we've seen President Trump, but I'm sure that that question will come up in next week's debate. And
if I can jump in
please,
here,
Rachel.
That's a little bit different. So right now, Trump acquiescing is a difference of kind, not a difference of degree from Biden acquiescing. Trump is currently the commander in chief of the armed forces. He has shown that he's very willing to call up unmarked federal agents when he wants to. So when the person currently in power is asked if they will accede to a free and fair election, that is qualitatively different than when the challenger is asked if they would accept. So even if Biden hasn't been asked, there's probably a good reason for that. His answer on this just doesn't matter as much in terms of his ability to do something about it.
And we'll go now to Barbara very quickly. Barbara, we're almost out of time.
What will happen if on Inauguration Day we still don't have a clear winner? Does Trump remain president, or is Nancy Pelosi, assuming that she's still the Speaker of the House, is she sworn in as an interim president?
Thank you for the question, Barbara. Let's go to one of our professors, Ryan. What happens on Inauguration Day, so in January, if there's no clear winner?
I'm trying to imagine a scenario where we would get all the way to the end of January and not know who the winner is.
Okay, so you're familiar with this year, right? And how strange the year has been. So.
Fair enough. Maybe I will make a note right now to think about it more.
Okay.
It would be Pelosi.
Yes, it would be Nancy Pelosi. Okay. If we don't have a winner declared, it would be Pelosi temporarily, yes.
Okay, so there's your answer there. Okay, I've got a minute for all three of you, and we've got the presidential debate coming up next week. Which candidate do you think has more on the line? Who really needs to solidify their positioning? And we'll start with you, Ken.
I don't think it's going to make a difference. Remember the first debate between Reagan and Mondale. Reagan looked terrible. The first debate between Obama and Romney. Obama looked terrible. I think there's more on the line for Biden because I don't think he's a good debater. But of course, not having a audience could help him and perhaps hurt the president.
Rachel?
Well, I would just like to go on the record and say something that might sound crazy, which is that I think it would be great if both of them went on Joe Rogan and quote unquote debated there with him interviewing them. I know that's something that has been jokingly discussed because to Ken's point, the not having an audience issue could potentially help Biden and potentially hurt Trump. But what comes out of this debate has a lot to do with who moderates it, how they moderate it, and whether they actually require the candidates to answer the questions.
Ryan, 10 seconds.
Yeah, I'll agree with my colleagues on the air, but I think that Joe Biden has a lot riding on the first one, but I think that Donald Trump, over the course of all of the debates, probably has the most to lose by far. Certainly the presidency.
Ken Rudin, Ryan Salzman, Rachel Bloom, thanks for a great conversation. Wish we had 2 hours.
Thanks, guys.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Talk to you tomorrow.